Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 12th of Tevet. And today we're going to be able to see Reb Chaim Ozer Grodzinski in Shut Achiezer, who you don't usually get to see too, the giant of the Vilna rabbinate before World War II. And the Bailan says that when he was killed or passed away, sort of Vilna lost its status as having been the premier city of Jewish learning and Jewish life. He passed away in 1940, just before the Germans captured the city, and the Bar-Ilan says that marked the end of Vilna's illustrious history. In the case, Shut Achiezer 334, from the 12th of Tevet of Tafresh Tzadi Vav of 1936, so this is 4 years before he passed away, and before... And this is sort of before the German war erupts, and while the Nazis are already in power in Germany, but the world has not yet been cast into its upheaval. And so the question, this is just sort of an ordinary monetary question. The question became, what to do? A man is asking about his son-in-law. His son-in-law had passed away. It's unclear what the age of the son-in-law is, but the son-in-law has a wife and he has children. When he leaves, he bequeaths all of his money, all of his possessions to his wife, and he makes her the executor of his estate. And in this, the will that he left behind, he wanted a tenth of all of his property to go to tzedakah causes, to charitable causes. The same way today, people in their wills often say, I want to give this to charity. And now she wants to know, the widow, if she's required to do so. So it's not clear from the tshuva as to who's right about the financial situation. It sounds like the widow is concerned about money, and therefore she doesn't know that she has the 10% to give, and the man who's passed away obviously wants to give the 10%, but he is passing away, meaning he said this on his deathbed as well. So he's got concerns of the next world, and she's got concerns of this world and how to keep the family going, and none of that is clear in the tshuva. The only question is, in the response, are they required to follow his orders and to do what he says they're required to do? Chaim Ozer Grodzinski's starting point is that we would assume that those things are shtar l'achar mita, meaning that he can't actually give those possessions to the tzedakah. It's not a full kinyan where he's made an acquisition of it to the other people, and they now are the owners of it. Even though there is a Ran and a Darim who says that when it comes to tzedakah, to charitable causes, if somebody says, sell azul tzedakah, achar shloshim, that I want this money to go to tzedakah after 30 days, so that it's as if he said, like from now and after 30 days. So from now and after 30 days means that the kinyan already starts now. It only just takes full effect after 30 days. And halacha, that gives it more force than if he just said after 30 days. So that's the way the Ran understood it for tzedakah purposes. That would suggest that in this case too, if a man says, I want this to go to tzedakah after I pass away, it would be like it would say, me'achshav ulachar mita, from now after I pass away, and give more force and more power to the kinyan, to the acquisition. But, says Reb Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, it's not quite the same thing, because the achar mita, after death, we're not able to actually transfer our possessions, because the moment we pass away, we don't own anything. And it automatically and instantly goes to our heirs, and that's a whole discussion of its own as to how it does that and how it works. Not our problem, but the Achiezer, Reb Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, points out that the Rashba and the Rabbi Akiva Eger later all brought up this point that Me'achshav al-achar mita, from now and after I die, is a different kinyan than from now and after 30 days. From now and after 30 days takes effect. So an example that comes to my mind that's not in the responsa, but let's say a man gives kiddushin to a woman and says, from now and after 30 days, I'm being mekadesh you from now, but it'll only take full effect after 30 days. So in between, she's like this in-between state, and the money doesn't necessarily need to exist at the end of the 30 days since he said from now. So there's all sorts of issues within that kinyan. When it says from now, it's a weaker form of an acquisition because the man cannot actually give things over after he's passed away. When the Kibager in fact had ruled that it becomes a sveika didina, we don't actually know the status of it, and therefore we cannot coerce the yorshim, the heirs, to give it up if they choose, if they decide not to. Chaim Ozer Grodzinski points out that the Ramah has a tshuva where he points out that the Beis Yosef, the Rabbi Yosef is the man, is Rabbi Yosef Kar, who also wrote the Shulchan Aruch. So the man who, the Ramah, followed his career, meaning the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, wrote all these works, or started writing all these works, and the Rabbi Yosef would come out with the very similar work just before him, and he would instead submit to that work. He was writing a sort of a Beis Yosef when the Beis Yosef came out. He was writing a sort of a Shulchan Aruch when the Shulchan Aruch came out. So he has a tshuva response in which he says that the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Kar, had held that this kind of a kinyan, me'achashav ul chamita, I give it to you now, or I transfer it to a possession of you now, for it to only take full effect after the person passes away, he says in the case of tzedaka, it would work because of another principle of halacha. The other principle of halacha, which applies originally really in terms of kodshim, in terms of the Beis HaMikdash, is amira legavoa kemisira lehedyot. That if somebody announces their intent to do something, to give something to the Beis HaMikdash, to Hashem, it's like they've already given it over. So the Beis Yosef applied that, or Yosef Karo applied that to tzedakah as well. Even though in the original context it means to the Beis HaMikdash, to sacrifices, to the temple, and things like that, he said it also applies to tzedakah, which is also a way of giving things to Hashem. The Ramah thought that there were other ways to read it. You didn't have to say, but at the end of that response, he says that if the Beis Yosef holds that way, certainly we should follow it. Meaning the Ramah is saying that he thinks the Beis Yosef is more authoritative than he is. Rav Chaim Holzer adds that that's true of Amira, but it's not only Amira, even Ketiva would work, right? When the phrase in the Gemara is Amira Tola Gavoa. If you say it's supposed to go to the Beit HaMikdash, but even if you didn't say it and you wrote it, that would qualify as well. Another complication here, though, is even if we said that was true, it's a little more complicated here because he didn't transfer it to any particular person. And there's a Maharit who had said, a response of the Maharit, where he said, let's say a man says, in his case that he was facing, a man had said he's leaving $200, let's say, 200 gold coins for five female orphans, whoever the executor of the state in that case decided was the most worthy. Meaning, he's living, let's say, in a town where there are a lot of abandoned girls, or, you know, there's an orphan's home where all these children don't have any parents and they're poor. And he says, I have 200 gold coins to give to this cause. And I guess in his time, maybe unless you gave 40 coins, that wasn't like a meaningful amount. He says, instead of trying to cover all of them, I want to cover five. And whoever the most deserving five are, I'll leave that up to the executor of the estate. So the Maharit says he's not sure if that qualifies already as zachku hayitomot, as the orphans already having gotten the money. Meaning we're talking here, so far, we're talking about, because the widow of this man in our situation, where the father-in-law is turning to the Rav Chaim Holzer, the widow seems to think that she doesn't want to give the money to tzedakah because, for whatever reasons, perhaps I think she thinks she doesn't have enough money to give to tzedakah. For whatever the reasons are, she doesn't want to give it to the tzedakah. So the first question is, maybe the tzedakah already owns it. Maybe by virtue of the man saying, I'm giving it to tzedakah, they already own it. So one option was that the man, when he says, I wanted to go to tzedakah, really meant, like, it's from now and then after mitah, as the Ran and Dharmit said, it's like from now and after 30 days, so this is from now and after death, and that would in some way transfer property. So he said that doesn't fully do it because achar mitah, after death, is a more complicated transaction since people aren't able, in fact, to transfer property after death. So then another option was to say, Amira tola gavoa, kimisira tola hedyot, that when somebody promises something, says something in terms of certainly the Beit HaMikdash, it becomes automatically the Beit HaMikdash's, and the Beit Yosef had applied that to tzedakah as well. And that would be true of writing. So then you might have said that by virtue of the man saying it or writing it, it already becomes there. Problem is, now we're coming to a problem with that. There'd be a problem with saying that is, he didn't specify a tzedakah. And we have this response from the Maharit who says that when the man doesn't specify the tzedakah, right, in that case, it was the five orphan girls. He didn't say which five. He left it up to the executive to choose the five. So he wasn't clear if they've already taken possession of it. It's already really belongs to them. Because even though we do say, he says, another principle that comes up that would also make us think that it should work more powerfully than we might otherwise have thought, we do say in general, that when a person on his deathbed or her deathbed wants to transfer property, so this Chazal made up this rule, and they did it because they thought the people on their deathbeds might be upset and worried if they had to worry about whether or not their possessions were properly taken care of. So a shchiv mirah is a person who on his deathbed decides to dispose of all his property, and the Chazal said he won't need, or she won't need, the usual modes of acquisition to transfer the property. And that was a way of calming him or her down. Even if he hasn't taken care of his affairs, if he wants to set them in order, all he needs to do is get people to record, to hear what he had to say where he wants all the property to go, and that will be like it's written and like he's taken care of it. So the Maharit says, but the problem is, that's no better than if he made a kinyan, if he actually had done, if he'd been a healthy person, and had made an active acquisition. And making an active acquisition, it doesn't work if you don't mention who you're giving it to. This gets into a side topic called Brera, which is that you might have claimed that, well, after we identify the five orphans, it'll turn out that they were the ones he meant it to. So that doesn't work in Kinyanim in this context, right? If a man just says, I mean it to five, and we'll later on figure out who the five are, so that doesn't work, and therefore it's not clear that the tzedakah should qualify as well, and that's true of our case as well. Since he said a tenth, he wants to go to tzedakah, but he didn't say which tzedakot, so therefore that doesn't seem to have made the kinyan already take effect. Okay? So all of that is by way of proving that in technical terms, is it true that the tenth of his possessions is no longer the widow's? It doesn't belong to her because she never inherited it, because it already belonged to another cause. Rav Chaim Moser seems to say it doesn't seem to be that that was effective in that sense. But while all that's true, he says, it's nonetheless true that we also have a rule in halacha called, and this is the foundation of much of what we call wills today, this is the foundation of much of that, we say, mitzvah l'kayem divrei hamet. There's an obligation to fulfill the wishes of a person who has passed away. So since she knows that he wants her to give a tenth of the estate to tzedakah, she is obligated to fulfill his wishes because there is such a thing. And the Rambam actually writes something like this. The Rambam writes, if a person is on his deathbed and says, all the fruit from that tree should go to the poor already get it. And the Magid Mishnah there, commented on the Rambam, says, don't think the Rambam means he's already given it to them because the fruit doesn't exist yet. And we generally don't think you can transfer property on things that don't exist yet. The Magid Mishnah says, no, it's a question of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet. That in this case, there's a whole discussion here about whether the Rambam really believes in Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet. But in a place where the man had made sort of a nether or a firm commitment, and in his life, if he were alive, he would have had to keep it. So then the Rambam thinks, Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet, what the Magid Mishnah says. And so too the Maharit. Okay, so then we would say, they should have to do it because it's a Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet. It's an obligation to fulfill the wishes of the person who had passed away. Problem here is that the Ron elsewhere said that that doesn't apply to orphans who are minors, meaning to the, his, he has children in this case, and they're not B'nai and B'not mitzvah yet, so they are minors. And there he says there isn't an obligation of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet because it doesn't devolve onto minors, so they're not yet obligated to fulfill mitzvot fully, right? Because they're minors, they're underage, and therefore it shouldn't apply here too. The Mach and Ephraim had pointed out that that question of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet and whether or not it applies to minor orphans might be connected to another question as to whether we think of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet like an obligation on the survivors. So let's say the children of the person who passed away were adults, and we say it's Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet. Do we mean it's their mitzvah? Or do we mean that the people who were supposed to be the recipients of this money have sort of already gotten possession of it by virtue of the fact that this person, this man, wanted them to have possession of it? The difference would be, and then it's not, maybe not so different, the Ramban wrote in Gittin that because of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hamet, because we're obligated to fulfill the wishes of the person who passed away, if the survivors decide not to fulfill it, the courts would get involved and they would obligate, they would force the heirs to fulfill the wishes of the person who had passed away. So if it's not always true that we force people to do mitzvot. So the question is, the Achiezer goes back and forth and he says it could be either way. It could be that since it's a clear mitzvah, we obligate them to do it because it's a mitzvah on them, or it could be that the other people have already taken some possession of it. But it seems like once it's a Beit Din issue, then it would seem theoretically that it applies to minors as well. Because when we say that minor orphans don't have to fulfill certain mitzvot, we don't mean those that Beit Din would be on top of. I think we mean the ones that are personal obligations, since they're not legal persons in halacha yet, meaning they don't have legal obligations yet, then we wouldn't think to obligate them. But if it's the kind of a situation where Beit Din is allowed to step in to force it to happen, that makes it a more objective situation. So that's what the Ramban would seem to think. But that doesn't prove it, says the Achiezer, because it might be that the Ran would have argued that no, that it's the, when we say this, you can coerce it, that's only for people who are subject to coercion. But with the Ketanim, who are not obligated to mitzvot, there's no coercion. So here too, you have more complications, because as we said, you might have thought also that he's like a shchiv mira. So that also gets a little complicated because he did not dispose of all of his property. He told his wife on his deathbed while he was ill that he wanted to attempt to go to tzedakah. So it seems like, and he told her he had written it down already in a will. So that seems like a shchiv mira kind of a situation, except that it's not quite a shchiv mira because he's not disposing of all of his property. But nonetheless, says Rav Chaim Ozer, it does strengthen what he wants, that he wants it to happen, and therefore you might have thought that it's also part of mitzvah kaim divrei hamet. Except that, of course, is in the case also, we don't know which tzedakah it's supposed to go to, and that weakens it. So you have all these factors, both strengthening and weakening what he's doing, and leaving us not quite clear on what we're supposed to do. Then he quotes, as I mentioned before, the tshuva d'zayit ranan. I didn't mention the tshuva, but the idea of breira. So breira is an idea, at least on rabbinic issues, when we have an event that's not yet clarified, and later on we make a choice about it, sometimes we say that we'll retroactively clarify it. So here too, as soon as they pick the charitable cause to which this tent would go to, that will clarify retroactively. So the question is, when does retroactive clarification work? And that whole area of halacha is called bereira. I say something that's not clear, but that's open to retroactive clarification. Does that work or not? Sometimes, yes, we generally say that in d'oraita issues, it does not work. And in d'rabbanan issues, it does work. So here, the Zayir Anan had claimed that if it's omeid lehit barer, it's clear that it's going to be clarified later on, then we would say yesh barera, even according to the Maharit, who had said that since the five orphan girls weren't clarified, it didn't fully work. But if it's omeid lehit barer, so Rav Chaim Ozer says, here it's bevadai omeid lehit barer, after she talks to his parents and to her parents, she's going to pick a charity. So therefore, it's got to be that since we've also said that him saying it is like giving it, all these reasons he thinks, Rav Chaim Ozer ends up thinking that she does in fact have to give it. But because there are some doubts whether or not this qualifies as brera, because he hadn't really said it, he didn't say a particular tzedakah. In the case of the Mabit, he had said five orphans, he had said five orphan girls. Here he's not even that clear. Well, but you have the issues of Amirat al Gavoa, Kibisir al Hedyot, saying it is like giving it. You have that it's a shkrim, you have mitzvah kaim, divrei hamet, that's obligation to fulfill the wishes of the deceased. So all of that together, although it's not quite fully clear, he thinks that we can give them, they have to give it, but he thinks you can give them time. And you can pay this maaser when they find themselves able to. So I think Rav Chaim Ozer is implying that he can't mean that they can spend all the money down and then say, oh, I'm sorry, I spent all the money, I have no money left, so yeah, so the charitable causes are going to get stiffed. I think what he means is that this woman has just lost her husband and she's nervous about money and she's concerned and she might have kids to raise and there's sufficient money to raise the kids now, but she's not sure what's going to happen. And if 5-10 years down the road, once the kids become all, you know, bar and bat mitzvah or financially on their own or taken care of or her financial situation clarifies, so at that point she can give the masa. Right? That's what it seems to me he's trying to say, that she can take time to get relaxed about it and to get comfortable with her new situation and to find her way and then to give the master. That's how I understand his words. His words are just she has time to wait until she finds the right time. But theoretically she could say, well, it's never the right time. But he doesn't mean that. He means that she can take time to get her bearings as it is, and then to give it. Then the question became, there was some life insurance money, and does she have to give the maaser, or she has to give a tenth of that as well? Because you might have thought that since it comes later, it's not really in his power to commit it, although he did say it in the will. He said, a tenth of my possessions, including a tenth of the life insurance money. So there's life insurance money. It could be that she's going to be just fine, and she's really just nervous, or it could be that she's just struggling along. We'll never know, because it's not a tshuva. So he's taking it as a technical question. He doesn't raise that question here about her being poor or not having enough. It seems like he thinks she has enough and there's life insurance money. So there too, he has a question. Does he have the right to commit the life insurance money, a tenth of the life insurance money to tzedakah, or is that not his at all? So Rav Chaim Ozer says, well, since the whole reason we're going to say you have to fulfill what he's doing ends up being mitzvah the kind divrei hamet, that it's an obligation to fulfill what the person who passed away wanted, so that would seem to apply here as well. Because it's not a question of whether it's technically his already, had it technically come into the world or not, and therefore it seemed to apply to that as well. But then he says, I also saw Achronim, other authorities, who said not only that what he had just said, until the kind of remain, and they said it's true of lots of things. It's true about Dovah Sheino Kotzev. Usually, when you say things about something that has no exact definition to it, that weakens your ability to talk about it because it's not well defined. It's Dovah Sheino Kotzev. Or to say, you know, give this amount in perpetuity. So, things that are in perpetuity and have no limits to them, that halacha has somewhat of a problem with. And also, Dovah Shelo Ba'al Olam, that doesn't exist yet. In general, we in halacha don't think you're so able to commit such things. But there are those who said when it comes to mitzvah the kind of divrei to the obligation to fulfill what the person who passed away wanted, there you're required to. And then he says, but his brother-in-law, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, so Rabbi Chanan Wasserman is also a famous Rosh Hashiva of the pre-war time, and I think that he passed away. He was killed in 1941. It was as part of the Holocaust. He was killed by the Lithuanian collaborators of the Nazis. So he was the brother-in-law of Reb Chaim Moser, a little bit younger than Reb Chaim Moser. Reb Chaim Moser here quotes him. His brother-in-law is saying and suggesting that you might say that since it's a davar shalom, that you might say it's not a davar shalom ba'alam. It doesn't. It's not that it doesn't exist yet. In fact, halachically, already exists. Why does it already exist? Because the life insurance policy was already bought before he passed away. So it's an actual debt that exists. So debts are not considered davar shalom ba'olam. Debts, I mean, if I lend somebody $100, that $100 exists. So Reb Chanan Wasserman had suggested to his brother-in-law, a life insurance policy already exists. I pay money into it every month, and it creates a debt such that the company has to pay me back when the person who's paying the money into the policy passes away. So therefore, you might have said this, and therefore, it would be as if the shechiv merah, the person who was on his or her deathbed, had said, so-and-so owes me money, and I want to do this and this with it, and that should be like a shechiv merah. Chaim Moser is not sure that he buys that, because it's different here, because they don't actually owe it. It's a commitment that if death occurs, then they'll owe it, but if death never occurs, then they'll never owe it, right? So it's not a loan exactly. So that's, Chaim Moser doesn't say it's wrong. He says he has to think about it a lot. He's not sure that's true. And so he's had these other reasons for it. Sum total, though, since with all the other possessions, he hasn't just said that the mitzvah, the kind of divrei emet, the obligation to do what the person who had passed away wants us to do, is so strong that we should do it. He hadn't said that as the only reason. He had all these other reasons as well, right? He had the reasons of, it's like a shechiv merah giving it over, and that only applies to actual possessions. It's like, amirato legavoa b'kimistir lehedjot, saying it is like giving it over. That also applies to the only things that already exist. So therefore, he thinks with the life insurance money, it's not so clear at all, and therefore, you'd have to think about it a lot. The other stuff, he thinks she has to give it, although he thinks she can take time until she's ready to give it. He doesn't give a definition of how much that time is. But that's where he ends up in that situation. That's the question number one, response number one for today. What do you do with a man who says he wants to give over money to tzedakah and the widow doesn't want to? Is she required to or not? And fundamentally, Chaim Moser Grudzinski thinks that there's lots of reasons to say yes, and all those reasons together combine to mean that she should say yes, although he's willing to give her time to do so. On that, on a sort of related topic, on the 12th of Tevet in Tuf Kuf Samach Dalet of 1803, I think it's still 1803. We're right on the cusp here, right? I think I looked it up. I think it's 1803 still. The Chasam Sofer was asked about, and this is in Evan Chele Gimel Chatam Sofer Chele Gimel Evan Ezer Aleph Simon Kuf Lamed Bet. Response number 132 in the third chelik in the Eben Ezer section of the third chelik of Chatam Sofer. He's asked about, and it's sort of a related question because it's about how much of money has to go to various purposes when they've been committed to other purposes. We'll do this fairly briefly. It's a relatively short tshuva, but also do it even briefer than Chatam Sofer does it. A certain rabbi had moved to Eretz Yisrael, or he had taken a trip to Eretz Yisrael, but it seems like he had moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he left his wife and children behind, and they have nothing. And so the Chatzim Sofer is going to be upset about this. We'll get to that. So don't think that it's just fine with him that he does it. But the question is, he's also raised money. It's unclear who this rabbi is, but he has supporters. You find rabbis get supporters, and they just do. So he has supporters, and the supporters have raised money to support him and help him be in Eretz Yisrael, be in Israel, because that's a mitzvah to be in Israel. So you have supporters to help him do that. And this is the early 1800s, so it's a reminder that some of the move to return to Tzion happened all throughout Jewish history. You had people like this. You just had many, many more of them starting in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then many, many more of them beyond that situation. So he's left his house empty, and so he wrote to her that he wrote to the people who were supporting him and the people who were collecting the money, they should give a fifth of what they collected to her. And that's not enough for her. That's one problem. The problem two is, so the person asking the Chatam Sofer says he doesn't understand because the money that was collected to give to him, to help him live in Eretz Yisrael. And Chatam Sofer says that was his original reaction. His original reaction was that you can't change the money from the purpose for which it was raised to the another purpose to help her out, even though she deserves the help. The person who collected the money was saying now, or the person who was asking the Chatam, it's a fair thought, really the answer should be, give her all the money because she has no money. She's a poor person. The Chatam Sofer says, I don't understand how you can do that because with all the sympathy in the world for her, the money was collected for a different purpose. How can we change money from the purpose for which it was collected? So the man who was asking the Chatam Sofer the question said, it's different. He thought, he suggested, that the husband had committed, first of all, couples in halacha are considered sort of like a single person, ish guf, what we say, that husband and wife are like one body, so it's sort of like giving it to him. And secondly, he said, the husband had made a commitment when they got married, we write in the ketubah, that he would work and support her. So, and this would be like that. If he's got to work and support her, the money that's going for him really should go to her because he has the obligation to support her. Chatam Sofer says, the truth is that's a good point in terms of the fact that we do have a strong tradition that when the man says in the ketubah, "Ana eflach," I will work, that he has to go to work even if he doesn't want to. He has to rent himself out in whatever way he can to try to support her. And the Chelkat Mechokek and the Beit Shmuel commentaries on Evada Ezer say that that's even true, not just to give her bare support, but support lefi kvoda, support of the level that she's accustomed to. He has to find a way to do it because that's what he had said in the ketubah, "Ana eflach v'ozim v'okir," and I will create honor for you, meaning the honor that you're used to, the level, the standard of living that you're used to. So whatever, however you exactly read it, Rabbeinu Tam had a slightly different reading of it, but however you exactly read it, Chatam Sofer says it's clear that the obligation to support one's wife is a significantly different obligation than other debtors. And other debtors, for example, if a person doesn't have the money, we leave a person with the tools they need to live in order to not to have to pay. And even if that means the creditors don't get all their money, doesn't matter. But here, we don't do such a thing, that he has to support her. And if that means taking all of his money from him and leaving him without anything to eat for the next few days, right? In most creditors will leave him enough money to feed himself for 30 days at a very basic level, but to feed himself for 30 days and with a wife and the need to support her, we don't do that. But the Chatam Sofer says, but I don't understand right now, as we're starting the tshuva, I understand the connection between that, his obligation to work, and the money that was collected from him. That was collected from other people. If he wanted to, for example, take this money and move back to America or back to Poland or back to wherever he was and he did that, he couldn't do that because they didn't raise the money for that purpose. So it's not like they raised money because they like him and he needs support. They gave it to support him. They raised money for him to live in Eretz Yisrael. So the fact that you say Ishto Gagufo, the wife is like him, that doesn't help us because he couldn't do it himself. He couldn't do it, so why should she do it? That was his first impression. But then he says, I thought about it more. There's a little bit more that I skipped, but I'm trying to get this in our allotted half an hour. But he says, I thought about it more, and I realized that you're right. And the truth, and I'm going to explain why. It's clear that he can't force her to move to Eretz Yisrael. And that's surprising, because the Gemara actually says that husbands and wives can force each other to move to Eretz Yisrael. Chatam Sofer says, not in our situation. The reason is, he says, I've written this at length elsewhere, that, I'm sorry, not me, the a tshuva called Me'il Tzedakah had written at length about this, and he had said that people go to Eretz Yisrael, and then they need charity while they're there, whereas if they had stayed wherever they were, they could have made a living. That's wrong of them. They're not allowed to do that, and they're taking money away from the people who are already poor in Eretz Yisrael. Chatam Sofer adds that he just recently got a letter from one of his students in Yerushalayim who spoke about how difficult the financial situation was in Israel at the time, especially for Ashkenazim. He says, this is the early 1800s, that the Sfaradim in Eretz Yisrael, and I don't know that it was true, I'm just telling what you said in the Chatam Sofer's tshuva, the Sfaradim in Eretz Yisrael hated the Ashkenazim, so Ashkenazim moved to Eretz Yisrael, have very hard time making a living, and this student who's writing the Chatam Sofer says that this man who made Aliyah, who we're talking about in our letter, in our tshuva, in our response to him, he said he would have had even worse trouble than he does, if not for this student stepping in and helping him out, and they had embarrassed this man, and they had mistreated him, and this guy helped him out so that they didn't, you know, come into his home and take everything away from him. So, the Chatam Sofer says that in the end of that letter, the student says, you should tell people not to move to Eretz Yisrael. They shouldn't come unless they have a bag full of money. I mean, unless they have their own means of support, because they're not going to find support in Eretz Yisrael, especially not among the Sephardim if they're an Ashkenazi. And the he invokes this beautiful Talmudic phrase, "V'chuli hayev ulai," even with a lot of money. It used to be like the old joke used to be, how do you make a big fortune? How do you make a small fortune in Israel? You come with a big one. So in the early 1800s, it seems it was like that and worse. So the student writes to Chatzim Tofer to tell people they should only come if they're really confident that they have a way to make a living, because we don't have that here. So if that's true, says the Chatzim Tofer, then he can't force the wife to move to Eretz Yisrael, which is a very interesting Kiddush. It means that what we say in the Gemara, that husbands and wives are forced to make each other make Aliyah, it's only if they can be confident of their ability to make a living. So, since he has to support her, that's a halachic obligation of his. And Chatzim Tofer throws in it, it's terrible that he made Aliyah and he has no way of supporting the wife. You're not allowed to do such a thing. You have to take responsibility for your financial responsibilities, and therefore we should really force him in all the ways that we could force him to support her. And it's not his right to make Aliyah and make her starve and leave her with nothing. And therefore, it's not only a chomesh, it's not only a fifth that he said, you can hold back a fifth. It's when the people gave money to help him be in Israel, that's their point. So the truth is that unless they find a way, he finds a way to support his wife, I would paskin, he has to come back to support her, to find a way to support her, do whatever he can, hire himself in whatever ways he can, try to help him make a living. So since these people very much want him to be able to stay there, says the Chatzim Tofer, so he thinks that then you can say that giving the money to her to support her is not going against their wishes, it's actually helping their wishes, because without the fact that she has money to support her, the Chatzim Tofer would think this man would have to come back. And they don't want that to happen. And therefore, and this man who, by saying that he wants a fifth of it to go to her, makes clear that he also recognizes his obligation to support her. And therefore, he thinks you can do what you need to do with the money because of this. So there's two examples of what we do with money in terms of giving it to tzedakah or not giving it to tzedakah, what people mean and don't mean. One about a man who passed away and wanted to give a tenth of his possessions to charity. The other about this man who made Aliyah, probably when he shouldn't have, and people were trying to support him, and how much of that could go to the wife who he's left destitute, which was wrong of him to begin with. So that is Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski, Chatzim Tofer for the 12th of Teveit, a responsive day. Have a great day.